KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning, Alaska, and welcome to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. While the stereotype persists that eating disorders mainly affect women, the latest research now suggests that these disorders, along with the related mental health conditions such as body dysmorphia and subclinical disordered eating behaviors, don't discriminate based on gender. In fact, nearly a third of people diagnosed with an eating disorder are men. So why is it not talked about more? And what are the barriers that prevent more men from getting help with this complex condition? Joining me today to discuss this topic are author John Hsu, who is joining us to share his journey and to discuss his new book, Louder Than Hunger, and Melissa Wentzel, who is a licensed professional counselor with Counseling Anchorage. Welcome to the program. Thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me here. I'm honored to be here, and I'm so grateful that you're having this discussion today.
Yeah. And
thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and to have this discussion.
I usually ask people how to pronounce their name, so I want to make sure I got those right.
You got mine right. Shoe, like on your foot, I always say.
All right. And Melissa, I got yours?
You did, yeah.
All right. I want to remind folks that today's program is live, and as always, we were interested in your questions or comments about today's topic. If you're in the Anchorage area, our phone number is 907-550-8433. If you're outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to join us is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell out line one. We will do our best to get your questions on the air. Okay, before we get started, Melissa, why don't you start us off by telling us a little bit about your background and how you got into working with eating disorders.
Sure. I'm a therapist. I work with Counseling Anchorage, which is a small group private practice that focuses on mental health counseling and eating disorder care. And we provide in-person and telehealth. The main office is based in Anchorage, hence the name, but we also have a satellite office in Sitka, and that's where I'm located. And we focus on an interdisciplinary treatment team approach, right, which is best practices for eating disorder care. So we have therapists, we have registered dietitians on our team, and then we collaborate really actively with outside providers. And why do I do this work? I've often asked myself that question. I started doing it because I felt like very few people were doing it in Alaska, which is, of course, is not true. I myself experienced anorexia as an adolescent, and, you know, eating disorder brain is still periodically present when I'm under stress. And I just noticed through my work that eating disorders and disordered eating behaviors and disordered relationships with people's bodies were so prevalent and weren't really being talked about. And it was this dark secret that a lot of people felt they had to hold. And I remember what that was like for myself. And so I decided that I would like to focus a great deal of my work on bringing this into the light, helping people release shame and fear and stigma around this topic so that we could support not only individual recovery, but how can we recover as a broader society and as a community as well.
All right. That was well said. I'm really excited about the show. It's always better when you have people who are working in the field, but also who have experienced it, like a lived experience. So I got two of y'all here today, although John does not work in the field. He's pointed out to me many times.
Thank you.
He just has the personal experience. So John, tell us a little bit about yourself and This remarkable book that you wrote.
Thank you. So I'm John Hsu, and I live in Naperville, Illinois, which is a western suburb of Chicago. And I started my career as a second grade teacher. And then, as I always tell kids, I got promoted and I became a third grade teacher. And I thought I would be a third grade teacher forever because I absolutely loved it. And then I got promoted again and I became a fourth grade teacher. And I absolutely loved being a fourth grade teacher. And I thought I would be a fourth grade teacher forever. And then, as I always tell kids, I went to library school to learn how to be a librarian, and I ended up becoming the school librarian in the school where I'd been a second, third, and fourth grade teacher. And I absolutely loved it because every day we connected with books, and every day we cheered for books, and every day I was able to share my heart through story. But for a variety of reasons, I left that position for a national position called the Ambassador of School Libraries. And I used to travel all over the country advocating for libraries and librarians and reminding people that every child deserves to go to a school with a full-time school librarian who actually has a budget, that going to a school with a school librarian and a school library should never be seen as a privilege but as a right. And through all of those positions, I ended up becoming a writer, kind of a reluctant writer though. And the first book I published is called This is a School, and it's illustrated by Veronica Miller Jameson, and it's my love letter to schools, that schools should be a place of hope, and schools should be a place of connection, and schools should be a place of play. And no one was surprised when I published that book because of my background in education. And then my second picture book is called This is a Story, and it's illustrated by Lauren Castillo, and it's my ode, it's my love letter to libraries, of how libraries are a place of connection. And no one was surprised when I published that book, but many people were surprised when I published Louder Than Hunger, which is based on my own journey with anorexia nervosa, obsessive compulsive disorder, clinical anxiety, and depression.
Okay. And the book, when I first, by the way, you have elementary school teacher energy.
Oh, thank you.
very much like second.
I'll take it as a compliment.
I wish he was my second grade teacher, right? Yeah, always have good energy. But this book is set up like it's Jake is the main character, mm-hmm. and it's a story. You mentioned that you kind of, it's written with a lot of people in mind who are your family, but yeah. the focus is really just Jake's head.
Yeah. So I decided to name him Jake Stacy because my name is John Hsu, which means we have the same initials. And the reason I came up with the name Jake was because when I was a kid, I used to play school almost every day. And my favorite imaginary student was named Jake. And when I was a kid, I really wished my name was Jake. And so I give myself that name in the book. And can I talk just a little bit about what the book is about?
Yeah, please.
So right away, you learn that Jake Stacy is in the eighth grade. So he's 13 years old. You learn the year is 1996, and I love to tell kids that my childhood is historical fiction, and they don't find that funny in any way. Jake Stacy loves language arts. His favorite book is The Giver by Lois Lowry. Mm-hmm. His favorite movie is Home Alone. He loves rollerblading up and down Kimberly Drive in the suffocating south suburbs of Chicago. He loves musicals. He loves Sondheim. He loves Into the Woods. He talks to Emily Dickinson all of the time. It feels as though Emily is his only friend. And he has a very, very complicated relationship with food because there's a very loud negative voice, an inner saboteur, that tells Jake that he's not worthy of food, that tells Jake that he's a horrible, awful, repulsive person, a voice that tells him that he doesn't deserve to be here and that he should be invisible. And it's the story of how do we muffle that voice? How do we talk back to that voice? How do we turn it from, as I call, an uppercase V voice to a lowercase V voice?
Because the voice will exist.
Yeah. Well, I tell kids, and I work mostly with elementary, middle school, and high schoolers, that I still have a voice. It's a lowercase V. And I have to work every day to keep it a lowercase V.
Yeah. And Melissa, you mentioned the same kind of thing when you're under stress, or that it doesn't just go away.
Right. It doesn't. And John, I absolutely love how you frame eating disorder voice as a capital V voice or a lower V voice. And I think that when it's a capital V voice, when we're really in the eating disorder, it becomes our entire lives and our entire sense of identity. And it's this strange experience of it seems to come from without you and is domineering and controlling, but it also seems to be you. And so there's a deep fear in no longer having that. And I think, John, you beautifully expressed the eating disorder voice saying, you know, you have no one except me. That's a very, very persuasive message to receive from your brain. And the process of eating disorder recovery, which for many people is lifelong, is of turning that big V voice and a little V voice, recognizing that it is not you, that you can have control over it, and that you are worthy of love and connection and care, and developing the tools to really provide that to yourself. And so, yes, when I'm under stress, eating disorder brain comes up again, right? It's here to take care of me. It's here to protect me. It's saying all you need to do is just not eat and you'll feel in control when there are all these things that seem to be outside your control right now. But I have the tools now to be able to say, you know, actually, thanks for showing up, but this is not helpful. And I have so many other resources at my fingertips. But it's when eating disorder voice is so prevalent and it's running the show that we're no longer able to function really adaptively in our lives. And that's when we have an eating disorder that's active.
It sounds like it's almost a tormentor and a comfort.
Yeah. It is, right? Which is very confusing, isn't it? It's confusing for people.
Yeah, because it feels like it's our best friend until you realize it's your worst enemy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry that interrupted you, Melissa.
No, exactly. I loved that. It feels like it's your best friend until you realize it's your worst enemy. It's so true.
Okay, so I've done a few shows on eating disorders, and it's always been sort of focused on the her. Right. And women, but men are, I mean, I was surprised by the number of 1 in 3. That must be sort of, is that updated statistics? Is that new research? Or is it just that men are getting identified more, Melissa? Like, what's the, was it 1 in 3 20 years ago?
It is current research, and I think we're learning more and more. Because you're right, we are increasing our focus on the experiences of men and boys, where historically eating disorder diagnostic criteria was built around research into women's lived experiences, which are far more diverse than we had thought, right?
Yeah.
And we didn't pay as much attention to boys and men, and that's one of those big myths. in society, that eating disorders or disordered eating, that it doesn't affect men. I also think that, you know, we started seeing notable and concerning uptick in eating disorder prevalence in general among all genders during the pandemic and post-pandemic, when things just felt like they were spinning outside of our control. There was a lot of food insecurity. And so I think we have a combination of factors that maybe we're seeing increases in prevalence among all genders, including men and boys, but we're also paying more attention to the people who've been left out of the research, and that includes men and boys and other genders and, you know, transgender individuals and BIPOC individuals who are members of the BIPOC community, right? So many people have been left out of the discussion.
Right, that makes things even more complicated. All right, I need to take a second. If you're just tuning in today, today's topic is eating disorders in men, and we'll be talking about eating disorders in general. My guests are Melissa Wentzel, who's a licensed professional counselor with Counseling Anchorage, and author John Hsu, whose new book, Louder Than Hunger, shares the story of a young man struggling with an eating disorder. If you have a question for comment about or a comment about today's topic, please give us a call. In Anchorage, our number is 907-550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5755. 952, and our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. If you send them in early or call early, we can get you on. Most people wait until 10 minutes before the end of the show, and we can't get people on. So call early and get your question on. All right, so men, can we talk about the prevalence, Melissa? And you mentioned a myth, but what are, you know, the prevalence of eating disorders in men right now, and what are some of the myths and misconceptions about that population?
Right. So you mentioned that if we look at national statistics, for every three individuals diagnosed with an eating disorder, one of them is going to be a boy or a man, is going to identify as male. And then we look at body image dissatisfaction, which is a really significant risk factor for the development of disordered eating or an eating disorder. And the statistics, pretty much the same for girls and boys, right? We have basically equal number of girls and boys experiencing body dissatisfaction. So if we look nationally, research shows that 77% of adolescents do not like their bodies. 77%, right? That's a significant risk factor for eating disorders, as well as other co-occurring conditions like anxiety, depression, self-harm, substance abuse, suicidal ideation. If we look at Alaska's Youth Risk Behavior Survey, the most recent was administered in 2023, and this is this broad look at what the experience of Alaska youth is, what are they grappling with, what are their strengths, what are their challenges. We see that 43% of Alaskan adolescents experienced prolonged hopelessness, right?
Yeah.
Over 28% engaged in binge eating. 29% were engaged in restrictive eating behaviors, right? Within a month-long period, minority youth were most affected, and the gender breakdown is pretty equal among boys and girls when we look at that. And, you know, I believe that carries out nationally as well. And I think that these statistics are sobering and concerning. And I know in my own practice that I see boys and men flying under the radar so often because many disordered eating behaviors are really normalized for boys and men. We're trained to look at girls and women and not at boys and men. And so I think that it's important to routinely be asking and checking in with boys and men in our lives or in our practices. What's your relationship like with food and with your body? What does that feel like?
Yeah, you're bringing up so many things. I mean, so many of us are dissatisfied with our body in some, you know, shape or form. And I mean, when does that normal, like, oh, I wish I could lose a little weight or get in better shape? When does that, what's the tipping point where it becomes an eating disorder?
That's such a good question. Eating disorders are so complex, right? And you kind of, you brought up a really important point that in this society, disordered eating and disordered relationships with our bodies are really common and normalized. Mm-hmm. I would imagine most listeners to this program could relate to not being satisfied with either their body weight, shape, or size,
yeah,
or how it functions, right? And I bet so many people listening could relate to thinking that you're not enough in your body and wanting to change something about your body, and maybe even engaging in yo-yo dieting or recurrent kind of restrictive fasting, or thinking about, I'm not enough as I am. It's pervasive, right? It's just everywhere. We're taught that our worth lies in how other people interpret our bodies, right? Objectification is everywhere. And then we're taught to self-objectify, to kind of step outside ourselves and look at ourselves and go, oh, well, that's not right. That's wrong. I've got to fix this, or I'm not worthy of love. And so when does that become an eating disorder? And I tend to think about how is this impacting a person's ability to function day to day? So if we think about those kind of classic eating disorders around which our diagnostic criteria were initially built, say anorexia nervosa, right, John? We're looking at restrictive eating behaviors. So really restricting the amount of food you're taking in every day, the types of food you're taking in every day. We're looking at compensatory behaviors, so maybe over-exercise, maybe purging, use of laxatives and diuretics to kind of shed pounds. And we're looking at that becoming an obsession. Am I perseverating on this every day? How often am I thinking about food and what I shouldn't be eating and how many calories are in this and I should be exercising? How much space is that taking up in our lives? And when it starts taking up a significant amount of space in our lives, that's when we start becoming really concerned that perhaps we have an emergent eating disorder. Is it interfering with my ability to function socially, right? When we're in the midst of an eating disorder, we're often not eating socially anymore.
Right.
We often have high anxiety around that. We might not be fueling our bodies and brains sufficiently to engage in our lives, to engage in school or the workplace. We don't have the energy or capacity. And so that's when we have an eating disorder.
Okay. It's very much like an addictive sort of, that's how you define when something is, you know, substance abuse, when it becomes, you know, a substance abuse problem versus just abusing, is when it interferes with your life, when you organize your day around it, when you are planning around foods and planning, you know, your meals, and when you, I can't go to that dinner because everybody's going to want me to eat. That kind of stuff. So, John, you looked like you were chomping at the bit
Up as Melissa was talking. I receive a lot of emails from students, and I received an email from an eighth grader last week that I thought of when Melissa was talking, and I'd like to read just part of the email, if that's okay.
Yeah, please.
So this is toward the end, and for some context, the student's librarian had read aloud Louder Than Hunger when he was in seventh grade, and he just wrapped up eighth grade, and this is what he emailed me last week. One night I just decided it wasn't worth it to live, and afterwards when it failed, I looked at myself in the mirror and I just remembered your book Louder Than Hunger, and I realized everything. I realized I had an eating disorder. I started crying and crying and crying, and all I could remember was quotes from your book, and I realized just how damaged I was. So I did the most difficult thing, and I told my parents everything. Me and my parents decided for my safety that I would spend time at a residential facility, and it was there that I started on my path to recovery. It was such a hard time being away from home, but I knew that I had to do it. Every day I tried my best to improve, and eventually I did. I did what I thought was impossible, and it was thanks to you. It was thanks to your book. Thank you for showing me that what was happening to me, that I wasn't alone. I want to thank you for showing me that it was okay to ask for help. Thank you for showing me that there is hope. Thank you for saving me. Thank you for publishing that amazing book. And that's why I wrote Louder Than Hunger.
That's exactly why.
Yeah. So thank you, Melissa, for having me practically search for that email.
That is so powerful. And I'm a huge fangirl of yours, John, by the way.
Oh, I'm a big fan of yours.
All my copies of your book have been loaned out.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Okay. We're up against our clock, our first break here, so we got to go ahead and do that. But if you're just tuning in late, today's topic is eating disorders in men. My guests today are Melissa Wentzel, who is a licensed professional counselor with Counseling Anchorage, and author John Hsu, whose new book, Louder Than Hunger, shares the story of Jake, a young man struggling with an eating disorder. If you have questions or comments about our topic today, please give us a call or send us an email. Our Anchorage number is 907-550-8433. Toll free is 1-888-353-5752, and our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. After a short break, we will return for more of our conversation. I'm Prentice Pemberton. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you responsible for a growing team of healthcare workers? Now's the time to invest in your team. When you enroll by June 30th, the Alaska Primary Care Association will cover the full cost of training and apprenticeship programs to help your employees get certified, advance their skills, and stay within your organization. Visit alaskahealthcarecareers.com to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Primary Care Association.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. For those of you who are just tuning in, today's topic is eating disorders in men. My guests today are Melissa Wentzel, a licensed professional counselor with Counseling Anchorage, and author John Hsu, whose new book, Louder Than Hunger, shares the story of Jake, a young man who is struggling with an eating disorder. If you have a question or comment about today's topic, please give us a call. It looks like we're getting some calls lining up here. So if you're in the Anchorage area, our phone number is 907-550-8433. And outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, back to our topic of men and eating disorders. Can you, Melissa, maybe let us know what are the barriers to men getting help for eating disorders? Like, what's the thing that's stopping, and how are they different, or how do they manifest differently than women?
Well, John, I'm so glad that your book really focused on anorexia nervosa in boys and men, because certainly males do experience that. And men often tend to experience something that's called, a condition that's called muscle dysmorphia, right? And so there, if you think about the kind of body ideal in Western society, the male body ideal, what men, boys and men are taught to aspire to, think about, you know, action figures and, you know, muscle men, we're taught that as a man, you should have a bigger body, you should be tall, you should be lean and muscular, right? That's the ideal body type. And so we see a lot of boys and men who develop an eating disorder around building up bulk, becoming bigger in their bodies, believing that they're too small or not strong enough. And so we see perhaps a focus on eating proteins to the exclusion of carbohydrates and fats. That's a real warning sign. An overuse of protein-based supplements, an overuse of those, which can often lead to the use of anabolic steroids, which are very, very damaging. An emphasis on over-exercise to build up that musculature. This is called muscle dysmorphia, right? And it's this kind of subtype in the DSM-5 under body dysmorphic disorder. And body dysmorphia, which a lot of people can probably relate to, is over-focus on a part of your body that you think is wrong, that you think isn't good enough, that you think is ugly or too big or too small. And it disrupts your daily functioning in ways that we had talked about before. And so a subtype of that men and boys are more likely to experience is that muscle dysmorphia. I'm not big enough and I'm not muscly enough. And so it can lead to really unhealthy, disordered eating patterns, an unhealthy relationship with your body. And I think a risk factor, there are so many factors that contribute to the emergence of eating disorders, right? It's so complex. We have genetic and biological and sociocultural factors. They're all in the mix, right? And you think about our exposure through media, especially social media, to the ideal body type and what men and boys are most likely to encounter. We think about many sports and physical activities that men and boys might participate in, where there are weight expectations that you have to meet a certain weight to be able to participate, or you need to have some sort of performance goal or weight goal in order to participate in a sport that's important to you. All of those are risk factors. And because routine cyclical fasting or bulking up is really normalized in many of these sports, boys often fly under the radar, and men often fly under the radar. They're less likely to be flagged by coaches or by primary care providers or family members as potentially having a problem.
All right, we got some calls lined up that look like they might be relevant to the conversation today. So we're going to go with Jake in Anchorage. You're on line one. Go ahead.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate your focusing on anorexia, bulimia, and this sort of disorder. But there, I wonder if you're going to get around to talking about disorders with overeating resulting in obesity and all the problems.
We can do that right now.
Right.
Actually, that's a very good question. We're talking about obsessive compulsive overeating, Melissa. Is that the correct term anymore, or
binge eating disorder?
Binge eating disorder.
Right. There's also a condition called bulimia nervosa, which would be binging and then engaging in compensatory purging, right? I'm throwing up, or I'm using laxatives, diuretics to kind of purge. Binge eating disorder, you're not engaging in those compensatory behaviors, right? And if we think about, I'm really all about releasing shame whenever we can, right? We think about eating disorders, they emerge to protect us in some way. We see high prevalence rates among individuals who've experienced trauma, high prevalence rates of binge eating disorder among individuals who've experienced trauma. Binge eating can begin as a way to feel some sort of control over your life, to self-soothe. And it can become a primary coping mechanism. And so with all eating disorder care, we're working on developing alternative, more adaptive or helpful coping mechanisms. And binge eating disorder and bulimia nervosa can really take over a person's life as well, right? So you're focusing, if you're binging, on really kind of ritualized eating behaviors, you're planning for your next binge, you're overcome by often guilt and shame around binging, and you're likely to hide because of that guilt and shame. And it can also take over a person's life. I think a unifying trait or factor in with eating disorders in general is they cause us to retreat from the world and to hide. And I'm really glad, caller, that you brought up these other more binge-based types of eating disorders or disordered eating.
Yeah, Jake, I think I might have cut you off a little bit. Did you have a more specific question around that? I just want to make sure that we get it answered. Oh, Jake's gone. Okay. Sorry, Jake, if I didn't get your question, you can email us or call us back. Okay. All right, let's keep going with the phone calls. We'll go to line eight, and Roger in Anchorage, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I am a compulsive eater, but I found a lot of help and hope with Overeaters Anonymous. It's a 12-step program, and I've been participating in that for a while, and it's a slow but steady progress, but I'm making it and I'm getting better. So I just want to put in a plug for OA.
All right. OA, thank you, Roger, for that call. OA has been around for a long, long time.
I'm glad to hear that. 12-step programs can be very helpful for some people, for sure. I'm really glad you're finding the support you need.
Now, the compulsive overeater, isn't that, there's a pleasure eating sort of factor to that, right? And the hitting the dopamine pump, right? Isn't that?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And then so you get stuck in these dopamine cycles. And we're most, if you think about any kind of compulsive behaviors, really they typically serve to help us manage anxiety or emotional distress of some kind, right? Of some sort. And we can certainly, if we have risk factors associated with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, we can certainly turn to eating. Some people certainly turn to eating to manage that distress. And right. It feels good.
Yeah, it does.
It feels good, right? That dopamine hit feels good, whether it's food or screens or...
Yeah, no matter what it is.
Exercise. Yeah.
And then you have the letdown and the guilt and that whole loop of I'm not going to eat like that again, or I'm not going to drink like that again. Or,
and that, to cycle back to your earlier question, what maybe perpetuates or what makes it, what is difficult about identifying, why is it difficult to identify folks, men and boys, especially with eating disorders, that guilt and shame, and John alludes to this in his book, keeps us hidden. We're afraid to ask for help because we feel so guilty and like we failed in some really profound way.
Yeah. All right. I want to get a caller who's been on the line for 10 minutes or so. Linda and Palmer, you have a question for us? Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Yes, I do have a question for you. This is quite timely. A good friend of mine in Indiana, her adult daughter, who is a successful veterinarian, is in a treatment facility in Chicago, a 3-month facility for a long-standing eating disorder. And my friend and I just spoke yesterday, as the daughter will be returning back to her own residence in a couple weeks, if all goes well. And the daughter has a workout room. She has a Peloton. She has a rowing machine. And so my friend, who, you know, of course, her and her husband will be meeting with, you know, the therapist, the counselors, how to prepare for the daughter to come home and try to help her not relapse, what they should do or encourage the daughter to do regarding exercise and this room full of, you know, very inviting, compulsive, controlling way for her to keep her weight down. So I could take the answer offline if you like.
All right. Thank you, Linda. And that's a really good question because exercise is healthy, right? And we have to eat to live. But those things are, so it's different. Like if you're, you know, a heroin addict, the thing is stop. But with this stuff, so how do people prepare when a loved one's coming home, Melissa? I think you could probably
and
take
I
that one.
I can't speak to this specific example, right?
Of course.
And eating disorders are so complex and really unique to every individual. What I have found is that it's really important to have a solid outpatient support plan in place before an individual comes home, and to be actively developing that plan with the individual and with their care team and their inpatient program. And having the interdisciplinary team all lined up at home, already talking to each other and developing an active step-down outpatient support plan, and having as many team members present as possible, right? Eating disorders affect the entirety of our human experience, right? They affect us medically, physically, physiologically. They affect our mental health. They affect our social health, our social well-being. They affect all parts of our lives. So we want primary care providers, eating disorder specialists on board, maybe GI specialists, dietitians, mental health therapists. We want a person's social supports present and part of that plan if possible. Family members, if they can be safe supports, we really want to include them. Perhaps friends and other outside supports. We want to help this individual who's returning home feel held. And the individual is the most important part of that care team. They need to be part of this conversation actively, and their needs need to be the focus of the conversation.
Yeah, I had the image. It's interesting you said wrap around. I had this image of like a team hug, right? Just this this group of people all surrounding one person to support that. So I think that's good good advice. Okay, John, I want to get back to like to a little bit of your story, and sure. I know we're coming up against our second break, so maybe I'll take my break first, and then I want to get into a little bit more of Jake and sure. his journey and what really shifted it for you.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, so if you're just tuning in, today's topic is eating disorders in men. My guests today are Melissa Wentzel, a licensed professional counselor with Counseling Anchorage, and author John Hsu, whose new book, Louder Than Hunger, is a really powerful story of a young man who is struggling with an eating disorder. We really encourage you to call in or send in an email for us today. Our Anchorage number is 907-550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, you can reach us at 1-888-353-5752, and our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue with more of our conversation. I'm Prentice Pemberton. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't wait 24 hours to report a missing person. As soon as you suspect someone is missing, call your local law enforcement or 911 to make a report. Be ready to provide as much descriptive information as possible to help locate your friend, family member, or loved one. Your reporting can make all the difference, and maybe even save a life. Learn more about Alaska's Village Public Safety Officers at vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Village Public Safety Officer Program.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in, today's topic is eating disorders in men. My guests are Melissa Wentzel, who is a licensed professional counselor with Counseling Anchorage, and author John Hsu, whose new book, Louder Than Hunger, shares the story of Jake, who is a young man struggling with an eating disorder, and it's a story that is about him as well. So if you have a question or a comment today, please give us a call. Our Anchorage number is 907-550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, it's 1-888-353-5752, and our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, we are running out of time quickly, which happens, and sometimes that's a good thing on a radio show, and sometimes it's not, and this one's not, because I got a lot of things we could talk about. We're going to hear a little bit more from you, John, but I'll go ahead and take this call. Fred in Seward, go ahead. You're on line one.
Yeah, hey, thanks. My question is not so much the psychological aspect of it, but do you check like the microbiome, since everything seems to start in the gut, you know, probiotics, prebiotics, as far as eating disorders?
Ah, all right. So can you tell by checking the biome is what you're asking, kind of?
Right. Yeah, correct. Yeah, thank you.
All right. I don't know that. Melissa,
well, there's increasing research. Increasing research into the microbiome, right? And certainly eating disorders, the more they progress, negatively impact our health, our physical health as well, right? We can develop long-term cardiac and liver damage. It can upset our hormone production. And it can also impact our digestive health as well and how that functions. And I'd say a physician or another medical provider, such as a registered dietitian, would probably have more concrete information on that. And I encourage you to research that if that's something you're interested in, and talk to some medical professionals.
All right. I have an email, which I think goes to the heart of our show today. And I think you touched on it a little bit earlier, but Amanda wants to know, if there are warning signs or symptoms of eating disorders that people can recognize in the boys and men in their life. Very simple question. Can you tick off some of those warning signs, Melissa?
Sure. And it's easy. They're easy to overlook. So just I'd say if you're noticing any changes in behavior, say you're a parent and you're noticing that your child is spending less time at the family dinner table or getting up and leaving it and going to the bathroom frequently, or if you notice they're not eating as much, or any loved one, if you notice they're not eating in the ways that they used to. Maybe they're eating less. Maybe they are eating in a more restricted way, if it's a boy or a man. Are they focused on eating proteins to the exclusion of carbohydrates and fats? Is their activity level changing? Are they more engaged in physical activity? Is this starting to become rigid for them? Are they withdrawing more? So looking for changes in behaviors. And then if you're noticing concerning changes in behaviors, having a conversation with that person in your life and perhaps suggesting scheduling an appointment with their doctor or another professional. But look for changes in behaviors and start a conversation. I'm really all about how can we utilize this challenging experience to grow and strengthen our relationships.
Yeah, that was my next question, is how do you broach that subject with someone, with a man or a boy in your life?
Yeah, if you have the kind of relationship with them where you can start the conversation from a place of curiosity. I think as parents, it's really easy when we feel afraid to feel anger, mm-hmm. right? As human beings just in general, and to double down on control, right?
Yep.
And at some point in time, if you think about best practices when working with children and adolescents, we're thinking about family-based treatment. And at some point, the parents may have to take over control of food preparation and management and eating. But starting the conversation from a place of curiosity and seeking to connect, I've been noticing this. And I'm curious about what you might be experiencing right now. What's going on for you? Have you been noticing this within yourself? I'm not judging. I'm not criticizing. I'm here because I want to support you however you need. So starting from that connective place with anybody in your life.
All right. Thank you. I hope that answers Amanda's question. But change in behavior, any new patterns, over-exercising, restricting, those sorts of things. Okay. John, I could do a whole show just with you, I think, after reading that book. It was really a powerful book. And at first, when I opened it on the e-copy, I was like, oh, this formatting came through strange.
Oh, yeah.
Right, because
it's what's all this white space?
Yeah, there's a lot of white space, and it's written in,
it's called a novel in verse. It's about 200 poems that tell the story. Yeah, but there's a lot of white space, and I think the white space allows you to breathe as the reader, because it's a raw topic, it's a heavy topic, but as a writer, the white space was really helpful as well, and the way that I structure the story, I think, shows powerfully his anxiety and his obsessive-compulsive disorder, and I feel that Jake's story could have only been told in this format.
It's really a powerful way, because you do feel like you're in Jake's head.
Yeah, you're inside of his head. Yeah, you're stuck in his head. Yeah,
you are for 500 pages.
Yeah,
and just the relationship with his grandmother is beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
And it makes me choke up that scene where, you know, he finds out that she dies and. Yeah. Yeah, I guess I shouldn't tell too much about
it. You know, I get a lot of angry
emails
about that. How could you have the grandma die? Well, it really happened.
It's a true story.
Yeah, it's based on my own story.
Yeah, so what was it that, I mean, thinking about an eating disorder in a young boy, because Jake was 13, I believe, how did that I mean, how did you get discovered, or how did they bring it up to you? What worked?
So I was really nervous to write a story about anorexia nervosa because when I was in the seventh grade, I was pretty sure I had an eating disorder. I wasn't hospitalized until I was in the eighth grade. In Louder Than Hunger, Jake spends a year in a residential treatment facility. I actually spent 2 years in a residential treatment facility, but the book would have been like 1,700 pages if it was 2 years. But one of the reasons I was really nervous to write the book was because I have this clear memory of being in the seventh grade and going to the local public library and finding a very isolated library carol with a probably Apple IIe and looking up the terms eating disorder and anorexia and bulimia. I don't think disordered eating was used as a term as much in the mid-90s, but it led me to materials that were really toxic and that were really bad for my heart. It led me to Karen Carpenter, and as a seventh grader, I wanted to be Karen Carpenter. And it led me to Tracy Gold, who was on the Growing Pains at the time and was kind of the poster child for anorexia. But all of those things, all of those materials, all of those interviews just taught me how to be sick. And they really worked as like how-to checklists. And there are many books that I read that I would never name because I'd be afraid that somebody would go out and get them, and then they would learn how to have better behaviors and fuel their eating disorder more. So that's all to say, like, what if I were to write a book? That would be really, really harmful. And I think I was able to write Louder Than Hunger in the way that I did because of a book that I wrote called The Gift of Story, which is all about the affective side of reading and writing. And in it, I write two sentences that were my, like, kind of guide as I wrote Louder Than Hunger. And it's always weird to quote myself, but these are the two sentences. One, that stories affirm our experiences, and that two, books can be the perfect prescriptions to let us know that we're going to be okay. Mm. And in essence, I wrote the book that I really needed when I was in the seventh grade and I was struggling, a book that wasn't going to encourage me to become better at my eating disorder, but a book that would hopefully encourage me to tell me that I need help, like that email that I received from the eighth grader, and to say you're not alone. And when the New York Times reviewed Louder Than Hunger, I was so grateful that in the review it says, in no way does John Chu glorify anorexia. Mm-hmm. This is not a how-to manual. This is a book that is going to save so many people.
Yeah, and I think that's evident by the email you got, that you were able to do that. And when I read it, it was really a powerful story about a young man who really was in a battle, right? It was a battle of wills between this altar. There is a good book that I like on eating disorders. It's called Life Without Ed. And that one does a lot of the same sort of thing with the voice. That was another really good book. But what was it that you spent 2 years? That's a long time. What was it that turned... I mean, how did you...
Yeah, turn me around. Yeah. So there's a scene in Louder Than Hunger where Jake Stacy goes to a bookstore in Chicago called Unabridged Books. And I visited Unabridged Books once on a day pass to see how I could do being out in the world again. And we'd have to go to a restaurant. And I remember entering this bookstore and just feeling joy for the first time in a long time and feeling so connected. And I remember thinking to myself, I want to live by this bookstore, and I want to go to this bookstore all of the time, and I just feel so alive here and so home here. And it was one of the motivating factors of, in order to like live here, in order to be able to experience bookstores like this, you have to get better. And it wasn't as simple as that, but it was like the beginning of going on a journey to recovery. And I ended up moving into that, near that neighborhood, and going to that bookstore all the time. And I visit it whenever possible.
So you found something.
Yeah, that's something to focus on. Of maybe, you know, I made the decision eventually, like, maybe I could be really good at recovery. Because when I was 14 years old, I went on the Oprah Winfrey Show. And Oprah's, the topic of the episode was males with eating disorders.
Okay.
And it was actually really bad for me because I became really known as a boy with anorexia nervosa.
Right.
People would recognize me out in public. And it made me want to hold on into the eating disorder. But eventually I decided I need to take all this energy of trying to be really good at having an eating disorder and instead become really good at recovering from an eating disorder.
All right. I guess I want to give each of you a couple of seconds to, or a minute to sort of, I don't know, wrap things up. We only got about 4 minutes left. You'll hear some music that'll start when I have about a minute left, and then we'll really need to wrap it up. But okay. Melissa, do you, like, I guess I have the same question for you. What was it, if you don't mind sharing, that really turned it for you?
My parents had me ritually watch the Karen Carpenter story, and that was not helpful for me.
So we can agree. So everybody agrees on that.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I think it was the support of a key teacher, John. A key teacher helped me feel seen and heard, and like I wasn't alone, and that I deserved help. So that was really key for me. And if I can then put a plug out in terms of seeking help, everyone, you deserve help and care. I'd like to turn folks to the Alaska Eating Disorder Alliance. I'm a former board member of AKEDA, and at their website, you can find links to resources, support groups for adults and for families, and a provider directory as well. If you're looking for a provider, whether it be a mental health clinician, a nutritionist, or a physician, so seek help. You have a right to be helped.
Yeah, AKEDA has been on the show a couple of times and have done a great job getting this information out there. But they are an excellent resource for anybody who has questions.
Yeah, I did an event with them last night here in Anchorage.
That's
and
right.
They're absolutely wonderful.
Okay, so what should someone do? Melissa and John, you can chime in here too. If they're sitting at home listening to this and they are thinking, some of this is resonating with me, and I might want to talk to somebody or start this process of checking that.
Can I read aloud the foreword to Louder Than Hunger? Because I think it does answer that question.
Okay,
right,
great.
So Louder Than Hunger opens like this. What if someone was brave enough to tell you the truth? What if someone dared to reveal their heart to you? The book that you hold in your hands tells a painful truth. It reveals a beautiful broken heart. Jake's heart. Jake is 13 years old and he has an eating disorder. You and Jake are about to go on a harrowing journey together. By the time you finish reading this book, you will be friends. Reading Jake's story will change you. You might find that you want to reveal your heart, tell someone your truth. And that's one of the main reasons I wrote this book. Telling your story can save your life. It may save someone else's life too. Jake knows this. John Chu knows this. This is why he wrote this book. For you. Kate D. Camillo. And Kate D. Camillo wrote a book called Because of Winn-Dixie and a book called The Tale of Despero and Flora and Ulysses. And I just think she so beautifully summarizes why conversations like this are so important and why asking for help is so important.
That's well said. Melissa, you have anything to add to that?
Beautiful. Think about someone who you trust in your life and start a conversation with them. Would be my number one recommendation. And then perhaps if you have a doctor, schedule an appointment with your doctor and get started on that path.
And can you give us the website for the AKEDA?
Sure. It's akeatingdisordersalliance.org. Okay. And you can find providers through their provider directory. But think about who you trust and start a conversation.
That's really good advice. All right. Well, we are at the end of it. So I sent my thanks to my guests, author John Chu and Melissa Wenzel. I appreciate you both for taking the time to be here with me today.
Thank you. This was an honor.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it was a really fun conversation. And I think it also got a lot of really good information out there. So my thanks also to Line One producer Madeline Rose and to our audio engineer Chris Hyde. For all of us at Line One, thanks for taking the time to join us. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants, and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.
You are listening to 830 AM KSDP in Sandpoint, Alaska.
KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time now for your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset. Starting with your coastal water forecast, courtesy of the National Weather Service of Anchorage, Alaska. From Sitkanap to Castle Cape, small craft advisory through tonight. Today, northwest winds 25 knots, sea 7 feet with rain. Tonight, west winds 25 knots, sea 6 feet. And Thursday, west winds 20 knots, seas 5 feet.